From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, Netflix changed how we watch television by dropping entire seasons all at once. But is binge-watching really better for viewers and show creators? And Stanley Nelson's new documentary takes an unflinching look at the tumultuous life and trailblazing sounds of Miles Davis.
The thing about Miles is as he changed, it wasn't like he changed just to change. I mean, Miles jumped in head first.
And how Grammy-winning producer Larry Klein recruited musicians from around the globe for his latest record. All that coming up on The Frame. Netflix and other streaming services have pretty much revolutionized how we watch television by giving us multiple episodes all at once, even though some shows like Game of Thrones have had spectacular success releasing episodes over a longer period of time. Lucas Shaw of Bloomberg News recently wrote about the pros and cons of binge-watching and binge-releasing for viewers, creators, and networks.
Netflix really altered the paradigm and the model for how you release shows, as it has so many other factors and facets of the TV business, by dropping every episode at once. And since this has happened, I think the TV industry has gone through this kind of back and forth conversation about what is the best way to release shows. You know, Netflix is having so much success. Maybe binge viewing and dropping everything at once is the best approach. But, you know, the longer Netflix has gone on, there's more and more concern about, well, maybe shows are actually getting lost. Maybe it's not putting enough marketing muscle behind each of those shows. So maybe it's better to go back to another model and release it weekly, or to release in batches. And what you're seeing play out as you have a bunch of new streaming services entering the market is everybody is taking a slightly different approach because nobody has decided what is the right model. Netflix is still sticking mostly with the, you know, release it all at once, with the exception of some different types of shows, mostly in the unscripted and talk shows. Disney Plus, which is Disney's new service, seems to be taking a weekly approach. Hulu and Apple TV Plus are both taking sort of a hybrid where it's sort of in batches, but also sort of weekly. So you're just seeing a lot of experimentation about what is the best way to release a TV show right now.
Well, I guess it depends very much on the show itself. So when is it advantageous for, say, a streaming network like Netflix to drop a show all at once as opposed to over time like a Game of Thrones?
Netflix releases all of its scripted programs, dramas, comedies, all at once. The only areas where it has deviated are kind of topical talk shows like the Hasan Minhaj show or the David Letterman show, because then you're often kind of going off the news and you can't really drop it all at once,
right?
Because oftentimes the episodes are responding to something. And then, interestingly enough, actually, there's a former Netflix executive who posted, kind of tweeted at me last week when I was talking about this on Twitter, that Netflix had A/B tested different models of releasing some of the scripted shows too, and it didn't see results that made it want to change its model. I'm a little suspect of this test. You know, Netflix does love to A/B test things, and it has produced most of the right results for them. But one of the upsides of releasing weekly is not just that, you know, people get time in between episodes, but you can then market and do all sorts of press around it, which you're not going to do in an A/B test, which you're keeping kind of private. You know, you mentioned Game of Thrones. That's a show that, you know, I feel like just dominated culture for months at a time, because you had the new episode drop on Sunday, and then in the week between episodes, that's all anybody could talk about, because
right,
they were so excited about what was going to come next.
What are some of the other downsides of this kind of, you know, binge releasing?
Part of the issue we've seen is the increase in volume of shows has led to discussion about this. You know, when Netflix first started to drop its shows all at once, one, it was the new player, and so there was just excitement around every show, and it wasn't making that many shows. But now you have so much being released. You know, Netflix on its own is releasing, not just scripted, if you look across its portfolio, probably 1,000 pieces of programming this year. Many of them are series that are being released all at once. And there's just such a volume that maybe you start something and you don't go back to it, or you don't even know something's coming. You know, there are all sorts of shows that Netflix releases that most people have never heard of. Now, the service's counter would be, what will show up in your feed is what its algorithm has said you are most likely to like. And I get that that's true, but that is not comforting to a TV creator who feels like nobody is aware of their show. And that's one of the reasons why I think you'll see Netflix experiment with its model and why some of these other services are doing something else, because they want to be friendly to talent that wants their show to feel special.
So, Lucas, what are other streaming services like HBO doing when it comes to their release schedules?
The changes that we've seen from those networks thus far have more to do with the volume than with the cadence. So HBO, for example, is now releasing, has historically only released new shows mostly on Sunday. They're now doing both Sunday and Monday. And I think you'll just see them do more and more because they're trying to give viewers more reason to see them as a kind of a daily destination and not just a once a week destination.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Lucas, you wrote a piece about how Netflix kind of earned a reputation for allegedly canceling shows too soon. And Bloomberg kind of crunched the numbers on this, though. So what did you guys find out? Does Netflix deserve this reputation?
It doesn't deserve a reputation as being faster to cancel shows. It lets shows go into third or fourth seasons at about the same rate as most other networks. We found that they were sort of in between CBS, which is the most watched broadcast network, and HBO, which is the most popular premium cable network. But I don't know. You know, what's interesting on its own is the fact that Netflix has, which was one sort of this innovative rule breaker, has morphed into a TV network that's a lot like the other networks. You know, I don't know that Netflix likes or that other people would expect for Netflix to behave in its cancellations like everybody else. It used to be that you'd go to Netflix because they'd give you a straight to series order, which means you don't have to shoot a pilot, and then your show would live on for a while. And that has changed. And the more that Netflix has made and the, you know, more conscious of costs that it's had to be, it's behaved more and more like everybody else in Hollywood.
Well, how does a big streaming company like a Netflix measure a show's success? I mean, by what kind of metrics these days?
You know, it is looking at a cost-benefit analysis like a lot of other TV networks, but some of the inputs and data that it uses are certainly different. You know, it wants to see how it uses things like watch time, kind of the aggregate amount of time somebody's viewing it relative to cost. It wants to know how many, you know, do people finish a season? It has historically also looked or paid close attention to whether shows are kind of helping to attract subscribers because it is a subscription-based service. So we'll look at, you know, how many views does it get in that first month, or how many people who just signed up watch that show, or how many of its viewers watch only that show or only a couple of shows versus a lot. Because if you're a show that, you know, is watched by a lot of people who just signed up or is one of the only things they watch, there's a higher likelihood that people have signed up or kept the service because of that show.
Lucas Shaw is a reporter with Bloomberg. As always, thanks so much, Lucas.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a tightly focused documentary on Miles Davis manages to pack 50 years of music into a single two-hour film. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. The subject of director Stanley Nelson's latest documentary could easily fill up an entire multi-part Ken Burns-style documentary. Jazz musician and ultimate icon of cool, Miles Davis. Miles Davis' Birth of the Cool spans the entire breadth of Davis's life and five-decade recording career, from his coming of age in St. Louis to his meteoric rise as trailblazing jazz innovator to bona fide pop star. It includes never-before-seen footage and hard-to-find photos of Davis. Director Stanley Nelson talks about taking on so much of Davis's career.
Sometimes, you know, in the era we're living in now, people are stretching everything out into 8-part series and 10-part series.
Right.
But I thought there's a way to talk about Miles and the music and the social forces that made Miles and do it as a feature film. And so that's what we set out to do.
What were some of the challenges, though, in wrapping your arms around this giant body of work and of life?
I think one of the first things we had to do was say, you know, we're going to try to represent every period of Miles's music, but there's going to be stuff that we leave out.
Well, let's talk about one of those earlier periods in Miles Davis's career. And as a young musician, he embraces formal musical theory and composition. He attends Juilliard for a time. And he didn't think that this would somehow spoil his skills as a jazz improviser or stifle his creativity. Did you find that was an unusual way for a jazz musician of the era to be thinking?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a great quote in the film where Miles says, you know, that other musicians thought that learning theory would make you play like you were white. And that, as he says, I wanted to embrace, you know, all forms of music. So, yeah, it's very different. I don't think there were very many jazz musicians who were at Juilliard. But also, you know, Miles is 19 and it's, you know, the beginning of the 40s or middle of the 40s. And he's at Juilliard during the day, and then he's downtown on 52nd Street at night playing with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and those cats. So it's this very unique education that Miles gets, and I think, you know, it's reflected in the music that he makes for the rest of his life.
You know, when he joins Parker, I think Parker was in the midst of his own heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. Miles was clean and stayed away from drugs for the most part until, I guess, around the early 1950s, and develops a really serious drug addiction. How serious was that addiction at that time?
It was very, very, very serious. I mean, you know, Miles, you know, hit rock bottom. You know, there's stories of him stealing other musicians' clothes and horns and things and selling them. I mean, he's at the bottom. And part of the spiral, the downward spiral, is a reaction to Miles. Miles goes to Paris and plays in Paris and sees a whole different kind of life there and is accepted in Paris and comes back to the States and says himself that, you know, the treatment of black people in the United States, you know, he's kind of looking at it in a very different light after going abroad for the first time, and starts using drugs at that point, as many musicians were, you know, in the early 50s, late 40s.
But once he's able to get clean, he comes back with such ferocity. And in your film, Birth of the Cool, it spends a fair amount of time on arguably his most celebrated work from this time. I'm talking in the late 1950s. And that's Kind of Blue, featuring one of the most recognizable, I think, pieces of music ever recorded. I'm referring to So What? And why don't we just hear a little bit of that to refresh people's memories? So, Stanley, when I think of Miles Davis and I think of this record, I think of it as kind of the delineation point between more traditional bebop sound to this more wide-open, spacious kind of sound that Davis would evolve into over time. And largely it's due to his collaboration with Gil Evans, the composer and pianist. But how do you see this record in terms of, you know, where Davis was going to go after it?
Well, you know, one of my favorite quotes from the film is Joshua Redman, who says, you know, how do you even talk about Kind of Blue? You know, why is the Bible the Bible? It's the Bible. Why is Kind of Blue Kind of Blue? It's Kind of Blue, and it changed jazz, you know, all of jazz afterwards. You know, it's this funny session, you know, how do you... What was the magic that occurred there? You know, we have Jimmy Cobb in the film, who's the final surviving member of that group. And Jimmy Cobb said, you know, I asked him, well, what did Miles tell you? He said, well, Miles came in to the session with a bunch of notes written on little slips of paper. He didn't even have sheet music. And what he told me was just swing. Just swing. I don't know, you know, how do you describe Kind of Blue?
Well, on the one hand, he could give his musicians this freedom, this trust. But in his personal life, he was often known to be angry, antisocial, distrustful of people, including his many girlfriends and wives. What more did you learn about what was behind this darker, you know, aspect of his personalities?
I think that over the course of the film, hopefully, you know, the audience will make their own connections and say, aha, you know, I kind of get it. You know, Miles was born in East St. Louis in 1926. His father was a dentist. His father, as someone says, was the second wealthiest black person in Illinois. I mean, they had a lot of money for African-Americans at that time. But he's still an African-American, a black man, you know, growing up in that part of the country in those years. And he reacted in a certain way. You know, there's a great scene in the film where right after Kind of Blue comes out, Miles is playing, you know, on 52nd Street, and he goes outside to smoke a cigarette, and he gets beat up by the cops because he won't move along. And these things affected Miles.
Musically, by 1969, Miles Davis has pretty much left acoustic jazz behind. He's bringing in electric bass. He's bringing in electric guitar, keyboards, Indian percussion. And it leads to a period of explosive experimentation, collaboration with much younger musicians. And I think, you know, your film really illustrates how he recognized that jazz at that time was just not drawing the audience as it once was, and he felt should. Was this period of musical change also in part an effort to, you know, keep up with younger contemporary audiences?
I think it was. I mean, but I think that, you know, the thing about Miles is as he changed, it wasn't like he changed just to change. I mean, right. Miles jumped in, you know, head first. I mean, Miles says, you know, I thought that I could make a better rock album than any rock album that was ever made. And so that's what I'm going to do. And so that's what he went out to do. And he made Bitches Brew. Sells 400,000 copies, you know, very quickly, and sold, you know, faster than any other jazz album had ever sold.
Yeah, and then after this pretty explosive period of Miles Davis's career, there's this sudden stop, roughly six years of silence between 1976 and 1981. What happened during this period?
Well, you know, a lot of times that period is referred to as the hiatus, and it was a really dark period for Miles. He owns this townhouse in New York. He kind of locks himself in the townhouse, does not pick up his instrument for years, is using lots of drugs and alcohol. He had a series of accidents and operations, so he's in real pain. Mm. He had like one of the first fake hips, you know, and that kind of didn't work. It made one leg shorter than the other. He's got sickle cell anemia. He's got all these ailments, and he's really, you know, locks himself in and is self-medicating and not making music, and it's just a really a dark period.
There does come one final burst of creativity. He does sort of break out of this kind of dark period, and records pretty prolifically throughout the 1980s. There's flirtations with pop, with funk again, with early hip-hop. What do you think sets this period apart musically from where Davis had been, you know, thus far in his career?
It's a period where there's some things like Aura that are incredible experimentations. You know, some of it he's experimenting with pop, you know, Tutu, you know, with Cyndi Lauper tunes, mm-hmm, you know, Time After Time. I think also one of the things that's really interesting about that this period is Miles, his personality kind of changes. So Miles kind of comes back, and all of a sudden he's doing interviews. You know, he's on talk shows. You know, he's doing cameos in films and things like that. And it's kind of a different Miles.
Yeah, there's a beautiful excerpt towards the end of your documentary. He performs on stage with Quincy Jones. And with this orchestra, and people are unsure if Miles really is going to be able to bring it that night. And the excerpt you show, he sure does bring it, and he sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I think that you know, that was one of the last concerts that he ever played. It's an interesting concert because there's some notes that they were scared that he wouldn't hit, and Wallace Roney is there on stage to kind of help out if Miles can't hit these notes because Miles is getting frail. But, you know, there's a clip near that point, near the end. It was like where he's playing with Prince, you know, at Paisley Park.
Yeah.
So, you know, which was just a great clip for us to find and for, you know, the people at Paisley Park to agree to let us use.
Stanley Nelson is the director of the documentary Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It's in theaters now. Stanley, thanks so much for talking to us. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame, producer Larry Klein has worked with a wide range of musicians. For his latest project, he gets literal about world music. Larry Klein is a Grammy-winning producer known for his work with Joni Mitchell, Herbie Hancock, and many others. His latest project is Same Sky, an album of 13 songs featuring 23 musicians from 17 countries, produced by Klein. He says the project's roots trace back to his childhood and his parents' record collection.
The first record that my parents had that made me aware of music from other places was Harry Belafonte.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountaintop.
And he was doing things that were informed by Jamaican music and culture and by African music and culture. And I just rifled through my parents' record collection obsessively. And so that was where I started traveling, at least in my mind, musically. And then, as time went on, I had become a bassist. I had gone from guitar to bass as my main instrument, and I finished all of my music requirements at Cal State LA and started getting offers to tour with my jazz heroes, Freddie Hubbard, Joe Henderson, Carmen McRae, Willie Bobo. And through that also, I started wandering around into music from other places. And Willie Bobo was really my introduction into Latin music, although he specialized in what he described as Spookerican music, which was kind of the New York Black Puerto Rican musical scene. And so he was really my mentor as far as the first person who took me deep into a musical tradition from another place. I love coming into a tradition or a style or a music of another place and figuring out a way to bring something new to that tradition. My new project is the Beyond Music Project, Same Sky, Volume 1. The main thrust of it is encouraging and promoting global cooperation and global collaboration. I think that when I first heard this whole idea, I have to confess, I had a lot of doubts as to whether they could pull it together and whether it could work. What we decided to do was to bring all of the collaborators from pieces of music that I chose. I had to distill it down to 10, which was, as you can imagine, from about 140, that was quite painful to do. And gradually we put together this plan where we bring everybody to one place, all the collaborators, and I would put together a core house band, if you will. Basically, we would just converge on a place for a couple of weeks and work together, live together, and make a record. And this started to get exciting. When I go through the list of songs, some are more related than others. You know, there's one song, Sa'at Rahman, which is a Yemenite song that was written by two Israelis. And it's about a Yemenite wedding in which a father is singing the song and celebrating and mourning the fact that his daughter is getting married. And then you have a song, Different You and I, which was written by a woman from Nashville and a woman from Amsterdam who became absolute best friends through the process of writing this song and getting to know each other. about the mystery and the mysterious nature of friendship and love. How you come to meet someone who's from a completely different place, but is so kindred to you.
I look up at a shooting star across the open sky, and I hear your voice say it's okay when I can't sleep at night. Sometimes it's so hard to breathe, you're different, you and I. That's what makes this world unique, 'cause your heart beats with mine.
And it was amazing, I gotta tell you. I mean, we'd have these communal meals and people would get up and perform songs, different pieces spontaneously at these things, and hang out and drink wine, and then usually go back to work after dinner. And even more than I envisioned it being, it was a life-changing thing for these people. Now these participants are using each other on their own personal albums. They formed these really kind of lifelong bonds, I think. For me as a producer, it's, you know, it's a producer's dream, kind of, you know, like having that kind of band and then augmented by all these people. It was, let's see, I'm going to musical chairs. Who am I, you know, what am I going to use on this thing? It was really great.
And that's all for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.